What is up, dreamers, doers, achievers? This is episode 59 of the Dream Big Daily podcast, and the ultimate person to have with us for a deep discussion, someone who embodies do the important things before they become urgent, but also the sign behind me, improve yourself, impact lives. The ultimate slogan we have for Dream Big & Co. But nonetheless, Dr. Oren Davis is someone who got the first doctorate in positive psychology. He serves as a head of behavioral science at Vervo, science advisor for Happify, the principal investigator at the Quality of Life Laboratory. Super fascinating stuff. And with all of that knowledge, he comes from a background of chemistry, science, and deep research in those realms, but has since evolved into becoming a science advisor, as was mentioned, but a consultant for many organizations and people. He said in the episode, he helps call people out on their bullshit. And truly, he helps people become the best version of themselves. That's it. Point blank, straight up, he helps people grow and become the optimal version in which they always want. Self-proclaimed self-actualization engineer, that's how he does it. He truly wants you to rewire your thinking and change your perspective. And there were so many times in which this episode, he caused me to ask better questions and caused me to rethink things. So this interview is not only for you, truly, but I learned many things from this. Dr. Oren Davis has such a concrete foundation in knowledge due to his research many, many years ago, but is now spreading that since he has such a micro understanding into such a macro level and helping so many people personally and professionally. So fun. We talk about hypnosis, flow, creativity, creative flow experience, mindset, the mind, his journey. And it's just, on that note, super fascinating. So enjoy. Leave a review, leave a comment, leave a like, leave any feedback, please. It would mean so much since we know you're enjoying it. But enjoy this one, episode 59 with Oren Davis, Dr. Oren Davis. Let's get into it.
I have a dream.
It's one small step for man.
I am the greatest.
You want something? Go get it. Period.
Nonetheless, I would love to give a 10 to 15 second intro, and then we'll dive right into it. Because I mean, this is one of the podcasts in which there's more things to talk about than I've ever recorded and converse with someone over a discussion. So I'm really excited for that. I've dove deep into your work in the past weeks since we scheduled this, but you're the, as they call it, Quality of Life Laboratory Consulting Principal Consultant, which is that your own laboratory inception, or is that you're a part of something that you've joined and you're just a major consultant for them?
So for the Quality of Life Laboratory Consulting, that's my own.
Okay.
I am also affiliated with a couple of other groups, so I do have that as well. And the Quality of Life Laboratory is my lab, and I am a research scientist as well, so I am doing actual research studies in the lab. And, you know, but it's the glory of being, for lack of a better term, following the scholar-practitioner model, that I'm both a scientist and a consultant. And the advantage of that, and the reason why I do it, is that a lot of companies, they like to use the cutting edge research, but I would say, you know, go to the source.
Yeah, absolutely. And for you, it's been interesting because in processing all the stuff you've done and in looking into it, you kind of went the route of studying the micro of things, chemistry, neuroscience, psychology, to then being pulled into an area where people need you most with like startup consulting, organizational behavior and development, which is super fascinating. And I was curious as to how that gradual transition happened. And then we'll reverse engineer, no pun intended, to like your earlier stages of your career in life.
So I admit it was a deliberate buildup. I really liked chemistry. Like, you know, just going back to middle school, high school, chemistry was really cool. It made sense. It was, it had rules, but it also had some freedom to it, and I liked that juxtaposition, and especially I liked quantum mechanics, and as I studied organic chemistry in college, I really enjoyed that. People kind of laugh when I say Orga was my favorite course in college, but it actually was. I had a great professor, and he was a really good systems thinker. And when you, a lot of people think of Orga as memorization, but if you have a professor that teaches it as systems thinking, it turns Orga into a really, really beautiful thing. And I really enjoyed myself in that class, just like looking at the different systems, playing it up that way. And then I got stolen by the neuroscience department, in part because I wouldn't be able to take advanced organic chemistry with my favorite professor. So in the meantime, the neuroscience department looked cool. I had always been interested in psychology, neuroscience, how the brain worked. Human potential was the thing that most interested me, but I wanted to, I really did want to get a macro view on it, rather a micro view on it, to go micro to macro at some point. And so, yeah, that was a deliberate transition going, you know, chemistry, neuroscience, psychology, and then social psychology. And as much as my work is, you know, about business, it's really the application of social, cognitive, and positive psychology to the business world.
Yeah, for sure. And I resonate in so many ways because for me, I'm all about optimization and discipline. And I love systems and I'm just realizing that. But even using Twitter a ton now, mental models comes up so much. Mm-hmm. And mathematics and all of that. So for you, I would love to have you explain like what mental models are and how you think about systems and certain systems you apply to your life, because it's all subjective, just as all of your work on happiness and fulfillment and all of this stuff is. But for you, I'm curious in that regard, and we can branch off from there.
So the way I think of mental models is sort of your internal representation of the systems that exist in the world. So it's your set of rules for how the world works, and they may or may not be exact, but they're sort of your rules, your systems, based on how you see the world.
I see. So I didn't see it as that. I didn't know it was a introspection type thing. I thought mental models. So it's very subjective then. So everyone has their own mental models.
Sure.
Okay. And for you, what is something, because I know you're an advisor to like Happify and these other companies, what is something they always ask you for with this science advisory work? And what systems do you usually help them implement when they ask you of these things? Or even at Quality of Life Lab, like what is your most pressing research and case studies worked on? And like, what are these themes? Cause I always work in cycles and patterns and meta themes. Like what do you find with all of those, commonalities?
I suppose you're going to laugh, but I tend to joke that my title is chief bullshit caller.
Yeah.
A lot of my work, a lot of my advisory work is, okay, Oren, does this actually work or is this total bullshit?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is a lot of what I do is I'm just calling BS on, you know, people like, yeah, we've got this new intervention that's going to make people happier. No, it won't. We have a better way of hiring people. It's not actually better. How about this new candidate assessment process? Is that going to work? No.
Yeah. And I know there was in one of your, you gave a TEDx talk, and it might have been something else as well, in which you gave a lecture. Might have been at Penn. But you talked about how there's like a three-step process to do things. And it's usually you face your emotions and then you accept and then you reverse engineer. So I find that like that disconnect is usually the acceptance part. And the people always talk about happiness. It's like the acceptance is so, it's just so, why is it so difficult for people to digest the truth?
So there are a couple reasons for this. Like I actually get asked that question a lot. So that is from a TEDx talk. And one of the things that I was talking about is that when we get a vision of ourselves from the outside, when we get advice, when we get insight, some of that is we look at how much it's going to take to get from where we are to where that is. And that can be a scary amount of work. That could be a scary number of changes in your life. And the sort of thing where like, even if it's better, it's different. And that means a lot of adaptation. That means you know, looking at things differently. I know that, you know, my life personally, I've dealt with a lot of changes in my life this year. Yeah. And, you know, many of them were good, you know, and they were, and despite how good they were, there was an adjustment period for me because it meant that, like, I have to live in a different way. I have to think about what's going on in my microcosm in a different way. And no matter how good those changes are, that's work. That's effort. It means I've got to change my habits. I've built up habits and, you know, I've built up my mental models. I've built up my reactions and, you know, my different, for lack of a better term, ego states, the different ways in which I develop the different personas I develop to react to different things in the world. And if you get a change in your life, those don't necessarily work. They're not necessarily the most effective way to go. Now you have to do something different. Also, what are the resources you may need to expend to get there? Right? If I say to you, you know, right here, right now, I think you could be the, you know, top podcaster on the planet in the next 5 years, would that scare you?
Yeah. That's a good question to pose. And if you're asking actually, not rhetorically, it would not scare me. But it's the light, not the darkness that usually scares people, which is so interesting.
I'm gonna point something out to you. That doesn't scare you. You didn't think very much about it. And that's not a knock on you. That's most people, they don't think so much about how that is. Think about it this way. You are now the number one podcaster on the planet. This means you are a celebrity. You are world famous. You are now getting mail, email, DMs from everybody. You go out on the street, people know who you are. You go out to buy a milkshake, people know who you are. Whatever you do, wherever you go, you are now known.
Yeah.
That doesn't scare you?
No, there can definitely be some annoyances to that. But it's interesting how my mind processed the end before, oh, wow, what do I have to go through and experience before it happens? And I know one of your lectures at Penn, you talked about that too, where you told people to count to 10, but they didn't really go through like the depth of how to get there or different ways to get there. So I do find that process interesting.
So just for your listeners, the counting to 10 exercise that I have is I take a group of people, I stick them in a circle, tell them to put their hands behind their back, and they need to count to 10. But the rule is that if you count a number, the person next to you can't say a number, and you cannot say anything except numbers, and no hand gestures, got to keep your hands behind your back, and you got to make it to 10 twice. With the additional rule being that the first person who said one, the original person who said one, cannot say one the second time.
Yeah.
Boy, does that get hard very quickly. There is one other addendum to the rule, which is that when somebody says 10, the person next to them can say one. Because otherwise it can become impossible.
So for that,
you also can't say a number. Once you've said a number, you can't say another number until everybody else in the circle said a number. So you got to figure out the algorithm. You got to do it without talking and so on.
Yeah. It's that word algorithms. It's definitely a good one to bring up. I was going to ask like, what are the solutions? But there's probably so many different ones to the group.
So there are a couple, depending on the number of people in the circle, there are a couple different solutions. Again, like I said, the most important loophole in the solution is that when somebody says 10, the entire thing resets. So anybody except the first person who said one can say one after that. Otherwise, you can end up in impossible situations where somebody says 10, but nobody else can count a number. So it resets after somebody says 10.
And what's the point of this exercise, like what are the main intentions for doing this with organizations or teams?
So a lot of it is the fact that the team develops a certain nonverbal communication. I don't want to give too much away because I really do think that people should try it and like get in groups and try it, in part because I think it's the sort of thing where you could describe the results, but what you see, like seeing what happens, and it takes teams quite a few tries to get through this. And you see a lot of frustration and people try to say stuff like, only numbers. People's hands come from behind their back, put your hands back behind there. And, you know, it's fun. And people are starting to show some vulnerability. And people are starting to develop a certain synchronicity. And that part becomes really amazing.
It's so interesting that communication's the one differentiator with our human species, but it's also the most limiting factor because we might overuse it. Because what I think of when you bring that up is the power of silence and obviously nonverbal communication, which is just fascinating. And I'm sure you've, as someone who does this research so much, it's probably so interesting doing this experiment with different people and seeing their different reactions, but there's probably themes to it.
There are, but at the same time, there are certain solutions that most readily show up, but there are many.
Yeah, yeah. And to your point before, I want to backtrack for a second. You talked about pain and change being innately caused with growth. So one question I had for you, because you do a lot of research on flow and flow states and creativity, is it possible to reach a flow state when just starting off with a new craft or a new art or a new venture? Or does it take time through the repetition of failure?
So the first thing, so two things I've got to push back on. One of them is it's not necessarily pain that comes with growth, but the expenditure of effort. It doesn't always hurt, but it is always effortful. So that's one. Two, I think people cheat themselves, and they totally got it wrong, honestly, when they think of flow as a state. Now, early research on flow did view flow as a state, going back to, let's say, the 90s, even into the early mid-aughts. As we started getting to around 09, 10, we started figuring out that there's no way in hell that flow could possibly be a state. The way we think of a state is sort of a binary condition, in or out. As we got toward the end of the aughts, around the time, first of all, that I published my dissertation in 2010 on microflow, as other researchers started publishing their research on the complexity of flow, we started noticing that flow is definitely a nonlinear construct, and it's very complex. Mm-hmm. And that even, you know, it's probably better to think of flow as an experience, something that, you know, that you look back on a time period during which you viewed it as flow and it felt like flow. But what we find happens is that the various characteristics of flow, again, forgive the pun, but the various characteristics of flow ebb and flow. And so you find yourself sort of going, you know, up and down, but in this multidimensional space.
As
you're finding, so taking that to your question of as you're just starting something out, it's perfectly possible to experience very deep levels of flow even early on as you're learning a task, as long as the challenge, or I should say that the level of skill that you're requiring is a high level of skill relative to your average, and it's something that's challenging to you.
Yeah, and when you brought that up, when I think about the waves, well, for one, it seems as though the way you posed it, a lot of people think about it in a finite manner, and maybe that's due to societal norms or, like, I guess just terms being overused in society.
That has to do directly with bullshit artists who don't know anything about flow giving misinformation to the public. I'm sorry, was this one of those, like, my job is calling bullshit? No, that's a whole bunch of bullshit artists who don't know what they're talking about. Not going to name names, just going to say that. Even the main researchers on flow, and when I say that, I mean the scientists, the people who did their research under high-level scientists who did the early work on flow, were all pretty clear on the fact that flow is not a state and that it just doesn't work that way. But other people who are not necessarily scientists or don't necessarily understand the construct took the work, adapted it, moved it in a lot of bad directions, mostly for their own profit, and interestingly enough, did not actually pay the scientists that they stole it from. And that's some of the most unethical stuff that you see out there today. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people doing it, and that reckoning will be coming. But consider this the herald cry that the reckoning is going to be coming, because the scientists are getting pissed, not just in Flow, but in many other areas. And in the advent of social media, they will be fighting back.
Yeah, it that's definitely a recurring theme. It's like the scientists get the short end of the stick when you see anything. And money always plays out in like the frontier of stuff, but it doesn't matter what happens now. The truth always gets revealed. So for sure. But the one thing I was thinking of when you're talking about the waves of, or the ebbs and flows of Flow itself, I was thinking of sound, and I was thinking of how it just, because I really like someone called Tim Urban. And he has a blog called Wait But Why. Have you heard of him?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Tim Urban is a lot of fun. And I think, you know, and one of the things I like about Tim Urban is that he also is very good about citing the research. And, you know, he really digs deep. And you know, the things that he's getting wrong, I think he knows that he's getting them wrong by oversimplifying. And I think he's very clear about that in his brand. He's like, look, I'm simplifying things for you. And yes, there is some nuance getting lost. And no, I'm not here to repeat the findings. I'm here to simplify it. I am simplifying it.
For himself, like, too, yeah.
I'm sorry?
He's doing it for himself as well.
Right. And he's, but also it's the sort of thing where he's not trying to mislead anybody, and his models are very clear. He's not trying to give people so much advice as much as he's trying to translate work to the public. And he's not branding himself as a subject matter expert. He's branding himself as a translator. Sort of like Malcolm Gladwell that way. And I put Tim Urban and Malcolm Gladwell in those categories, and they're doing great stuff because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. But I brought him up because that same simplification thing, he made me understand, or he caused me to understand sound, in that it's more of this like constant wave instead of just this one push. Because it's like Flow, as you said, a lot of people consume or think of Flow as this one state and this one experience just in this like finite period of time. And the same thing for sound. It's like you hear a bird chirp, and when it hits you, you're like, oh, that's sound. But it's actually happening up until it hits you. It's traveling over whatever XY. I don't know about it, so I'm not gonna talk too much about it. But Tim Urban, I'll probably put in the description. His one article does a great job of breaking down sound. But the other thing I was gonna bring up with you was, what have you changed your mind on within 2020? Within the context of creativity or organizational behavior, because right now, and especially as a researcher, you're constantly changing. And I admire that about people who do research. You guys constantly have to change your mind, and you have to have the courage to do that, because it's kind of, you know, in a political way, people see changing their mind as bad and they judge it in a negative way. So for you, what have you changed your mind on with some research you've been doing, or findings you've been discovering, or things you've been seeing in 2020 play out?
Wow, that's a really tough question, because I don't always track how my mind changes, and so I don't always know. Like, you're asking me in 2020, as I develop new ideas, in that sense, my mind's constantly changing. And often we think of change as sort of like, you know, pivoting and doing a 180. Whereas the reality is that we're constantly making shifts all the time. And so it's sort of like, you know, how I might have pivoted from one small thing to one other small thing to some other small thing.
Yeah.
Things like that. I think partly the model, one of the things that was a big shift for me was sort of recognizing increasingly the limits of systems and algorithms. I've always liked systems. I've always liked algorithms. I love mechanisms, but they've got limits. Algorithms have limits. And I've spent a lot of time in the last year reflecting on a paraphrase. It's not actually what he said, but it's a paraphrase of the statistician George Box. All models are wrong. Some models are useful. And I've really been reflecting on that in the past year as I'm seeing increasing numbers of models, models of the pandemic, models of the election, you know, models of polls, and I've always had both simultaneously a very strong respect and a healthy disrespect for the numbers, and that's both my respect for the numbers and my disrespect for the numbers. Those have both increased this year, and my healthy respect and disrespect for models has also developed in the last year as I've been looking at more and more models that just are total bullshit, and the extent to which people are honestly willing to believe them and not even look into the model. It's like if you wave numbers in front of somebody's face, they just start oohing and aahing.
Yeah,
you know, as if you did magic and...
As though you did hypnosis.
Not even. I mean, you know, that's not even hypnosis. That's just an automatic response because people don't understand numbers and they haven't been taught to work with them, and they certainly haven't been taught to think critically about models.
Mm.
And, you know, that's been very frustrating to watch and somewhat challenging as well.
Yeah, because that's really interesting, and that's especially because you're in that field. So it's sort of like a full stack front and back end developer for Twitter not liking social media apps. Like,
yeah.
So how are you navigating your dislike with things with your interest and your striving for mastery within this field, within this realm?
So for example, a lot of what I'm thinking about is how can I use the models well, right? How do I make a useful model? And so some of the stuff that I've been working on, I've been spending a little more time at the drawing board about what my models can do. So one of the models I've been working on secretly for a very long time, it's about 11 years now I've been developing this model. And one of many reasons I haven't put it out there yet is I don't like the possible misuses of what I'd be putting out. And until I can come up with a user manual that says very, very clearly, here's where you can use it, here's where you can't use it, this is an ethical use of my model, this is an unethical use of my model, because I don't want there to be any mistakes, number one. Number two, I don't want bullshit artists grabbing my work and saying, like, you know, I'm going to charge you money to interpret Davis's model on this. No. You.
I see where it plays out in society then. That makes sense. Yeah.
And people, for example, using the MBTI in ridiculous ways, or even using Big Five in weird ways.
What is that for context? Will you just
Myers-Briggs.
Myers-Briggs, okay.
Which is total nonsense. Yeah, yeah. Myers-Briggs is pretty much nonsense. It's cute, but it's neither a useful theory, nor is it it's not a useful model, nor is it a correct model. So, but Big Five, I'm watching people take Big Five into all sorts of places and giving Big Five all sorts of interpretations that when you go back to Costin McRae's original work, like, that's not what they said.
Hmm. Yeah, and what you brought up in the beginning with how you approach stuff is, I connected a dot with you with how Ray Dalio goes about some things. He says, instead of knowing I'm right, the way he approaches life now is like, how do I know I'm right? And it causes this like openness and vulnerability to things. That's why he has such an amazing organization with Bridgewater Associates. It's like his radical transparency, he calls it, within his organization. But it's that willingness to ask, how do I know I'm right? That puts the gates of pride down and of control down. So in that same way, you have to approach that as the scientist you are.
Yeah, and part of that is, you know, I remember this very well as a graduate student, definitely having some serious imposter syndrome and like being afraid to defend, like, I don't know what I'm doing, I don't know what I'm talking about, because one of the things that becoming a scientist teaches you is you don't know jack. And as you're becoming, and the funny thing is, like, the world looks at you as a world-leading expert, and you have a very, very clear idea of just how little you know. And the more you study, you really, really understand how little you know. And that juxtaposition is really, really hard. And I found one of the best inspirations I got on this was, I don't know if it's apocryphal, I don't know who said this, I'd love to find out if it really happened. Supposedly, there was a quantum mechanics professor who started his course on quantum mechanics this way. He said, students, I know nothing about quantum mechanics. You're here because you know less.
Yeah, that's a good way.
Similarly, I think this might have been Niels Bohr who said, "If thinking about quantum mechanics doesn't give you a headache, you don't get it."
Yeah, exactly.
Something along those lines. I don't remember if it was David Bohm, Niels Bohr. I think it was Niels Bohr, and I didn't get the quote right, but it's something to that effect.
Now that the uncontrollability, it always pops up when I, at the end of the day, it boils down to exactly that. You realize how minuscule you are in the grander schemes of things, but especially you as like the pioneer and sort of pushing that needle forward through like theory and research and application. It's like you also have to accept the fact, especially entrepreneurs do, where it's like they're figuring out as they go. Like mm-hmm. even the best, it's kind of just this transition from generation to generation, just pushing that needle forward.
So the irony is somebody once asked me, what is it you think, you've been studying flow for probably almost 15 years. What is it you think you don't know about flow? And I just like gave them a list of all the stuff I just do not understand about this. And somebody was shocked to figure out like how, and funnily enough, I actually got in trouble for this because I once tried to write a paper about how little we know about flow. Let's just say that, first of all, nothing I said was anything Csikszentmihalyi disagreed with. He and I talked about it because he was my advisor. We talked about this at length. But there were other people whose feathers that ruffled, and they wouldn't let me publish that chapter.
Interesting. I mean, I guess that gives some representation into the, like, I'll bring up the word again, pride of how good we think we are and how much we think we know.
Okay. A colleague of mine and a fellow student of Csikszentmihalyi's prior to my time, Sami Abu Amde, just put out an incredible article, and he did the job for me, and I'm thrilled he did it. And honestly, Sammy probably could have done it better than I did, and I'm glad he did it.
Yeah, and the one thing I was gonna ask you was you talked about before this uncontrollability of things, but also, and it might come back to me, but it was really top of mind before. But a lot of what I realized, because I like to work in themes, as I said, mm-hmm. and so should many people, a lot of your work is like this, the quote says behind me, it's kind of like improving yourself to then improve others, but also doing the important things before they become urgent. And when I saw your bio of this self-actualization engineer, I've never heard of that usage of it before. Usually it's just self-actualization. Mm-hmm. But for you, you're a self-actualization engineer, so you're literally studying the concepts and how this occur. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested into how you define self-actualization and then what goes on in the brain when we try to fulfill certain desires. Because I know it's a long process, but we have to pick and choose our desires in life and like what really goes on behind the scenes to that. And then I would really love to dive into that more in hypnosis and things of that I'm unknowing about.
Sure. So I borrow a lot from Maslow and self-actualization, and I'm still catching up on Scott Barry Kaufman's new theory of self-actualization. He really dove into Maslow, and I admit I'm a little bit behind on the latest work on self-actualization. That's just been a time thing. I'm excited to see what Scott Barry Kaufman's come up with in his new book, Transcend, which, by the way, if you have not read it, I found that everything Scott writes is very much worthwhile to read. So definitely, if you're interested in self-actualization, and if you're interested in intelligence, creativity, everything that Scott has written that I have seen has been a great read. But anyway, I look at self-actualization as the fulfillment of your potential. That's still kind of a fuzzy definition, I freely admit. And the idea is that you've got a uniqueness to you. Every single person's got a uniqueness, and that uniqueness endows them with the wherewithal to make a contribution to the world that nobody else can make. And so the idea is that each of us as individuals fulfills the promise of that uniqueness, makes that contribution, you know, in their own inimitable fashion. And as such, the world changes.
Mm.
And so, you know, in that sense, Maslow pointed out in his last book, which was published posthumously, The Farther Reaches of Human Nature, Maslow points out that self-actualization is not the top, nor is it really a top at all, but it's not even a hierarchy so much, but that beyond that is self-transcendence. And that's going beyond yourself, creating something that lasts beyond. And so, you know, as much as you're going through the different degrees of need, I mean, hierarchy is so fuzzy, and it's certainly not a pyramid. Maslow didn't do that whole pyramid thing. He didn't do that.
But to the one point of that, I really did, when you brought it up on another podcast, but then now, this thing of going above the clouds and outside yourself. And for you, you're saying you call people out and they're bullshit. Like if you want to put it in a cultural slangy term, you call people out and they're bullshit and you help people get out of their own way. And it's so often that to transcend the clouds, we just have to get out of our own way. And for you, with working with so many people, and I know we referenced it before with pitfalls you find in the experiment you do with the numbers, 1 through 10, what do you find hinders people most when trying to go outside themselves? Because the ones who are doing it the best in whatever industry they're in, they're playing a whole different game. You know, they're the ones making the most money. They're playing the whole different game. Even if money didn't matter, they're just on a different level. Whether it be in music, you have people like Kanye, J. Cole, Lil Wayne when he was like Tupac, Biggie, whatever. And then you have people like entrepreneurs of the realm of Gary Vee or Tom Bilyeu. What do you find is a hindrance for not getting to that level?
So I think the irony is you actually answered your own question. It's that those people don't play anybody else's game.
They don't play.
Now, is one of the points I was also trying to make in my TED Talk is don't play anybody else's game. Feel free to learn the other games that people play or the other bits of advice or systems that people follow, but build your own. Like you look at Gary Vee, part of what makes him so awesome is he said, screw this, I know who I am and I'm going to make my own system. Ray Dalio did the same.
Yeah.
And you know, thinking back, you mentioned a whole bunch of hip hop artists, but I mean, look at Jay-Z, who I think, you know, Jay-Z was probably one of the most successful hip hop artists.
Have to bring Jay-Z up.
You have to bring Jay-Z up because he's such an icon in so many significant ways. And in a lot of ways, he was the game maker.
Mm.
Not just the game changer, but Jay-Z was the game maker.
Yeah, you get to the point where you go above the clouds, but then you're the one, like, I don't want to sound like an ominous being, but like you create the clouds in a way, and like you're the one who makes the game. That's interesting. Yeah, well, it's like you learn the rules. As you talk about it, you learn yourself, you learn the rules, you play it well, and then you create the game eventually. Yeah. So you have to enter, as they say, like archetypally, like the dragon's lair in order to become like the dragon slayer before. Yeah, I like that a lot.
But you also, and one of the things that happens very often and often gets skipped over in a lot of stories, is you're supposed to build your own tools and weapons. So one thing, for example, in the Star Wars world that a lot of people miss is that traditionally Jedi make their own lightsabers.
Mm.
And that's an important detail.
Yeah. Can't miss out on that. That's true. So then, if there's so many things out there, would you say the only point for looking outside yourself is to get advice on how people do things so you can apply it to your own?
In a sense, yeah. And I think, for example, like when you cook, you know, you go to stores, you buy ingredients, you look up recipes and so on, but you have your own taste, you have your own style. At first, maybe you are copying other people, but at a certain point, if you're doing this actively, you get to know your own style, you get to know your own taste, you get to know how other people taste and what their tastes are. And from there, you start being able to cater your taste to other people's taste, to perhaps even a broader set of tastes. And you understand different cooking styles and you can integrate them to make your own. So, I mean, one of my favorite examples on this is Masaru Morimoto, who did amazing work, and he did a lot of neat fusion work. And if you look at the style he developed, it's very clear you can see different influences from other food experts, but he's made his own thing. And it is incredible to see some of the things that he has created.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And for those who are too inside themselves in a selfish way, and they're too caught up in their own world, but also past traumas or future angst, what is a way in which they can, or like common tools they can use and guides to get outside themselves without any drug usage or any of that in order to come back to the correct way of doing things? Because in a way of breaking it down, a simplified question, how does someone step away from their magnifying glass of looking too close at things to then step away to see this bigger picture, even though what they're focused on might seem like it's a big problem, even though it's not?
Mm-hmm. So there are a couple things that you brought up there. And I want to go back to one of your earlier questions in answer to this one. You were asking before what goes on in the brain. The answer to that is we have no idea. Nobody knows this. We're guessing. We're shooting in the dark. And some people are hitting targets. But right now, we really don't know much. And so as we're asking, like, what's going on in the brain, we're making guesses. A lot of the studies are underpowered. They are not necessarily so accurate. But and I'm not saying that this shouldn't be done. It should be done. But we need to recognize that neuroscience is not a fast-moving field. As much as it looks like it's moving fast, it's a lot of moving fast and breaking things. But a lot of those breaking things are, damn, we broke something, now we got to clean that up. It's not like breaking barriers. It's just we broke something, something went wrong. Or, you know, we just made a much better guess. But human thinking is extremely complex, and so is the human brain. Similarly, for that very reason, one of the biggest questions that's currently existing in psychiatry is, do drugs actually work? And I'm not coming down on a side on that, because to be quite honest with you, I don't understand the literature on this. I've read literature that says that the drugs work well. I've read literature that says that the drugs don't. And just not having the expertise in the background, I don't know on that one. I really just don't understand it. So what I would say is that anybody who's considering getting treatment for any sort of mental health issue without drugs should be consulting with educated, well-educated, certified professionals who will get to know you and will get to know what you're about and will be able to give a much better analysis of whether drugs may be helpful or not. The one thing I think everybody agrees on is that drugs are adjunctive and that drugs are not the solution. Drugs are, when drugs are appropriate, they're there in a certain sense to take the edge off so that you can work your way through the challenges and hopefully eventually get off them. Now, for some people, that's never going to happen. They're never going to be able to get off the medication for various reasons. And again, I admit that I'm like talking way out of my lane and zone, so I don't guarantee the accuracy of what I'm saying, but it seems like most people agree that the goal is to get off the drugs, but that not everybody will actually realistically be able to hit that goal.
Yeah. But then for that same individual who's caught up within their own internal process of what's going on, they oftentimes can't come to agreements with someone else, because a lot of the times you don't want to argue with someone who's angry. It's just, it's impenetrable. Like, and this is no reference to political debates going on, but like, if you have people that are just stringent in their ways, what are ways in which you can open up their viewpoint to then interject like a calmer way of looking at things, or like a perspective that'll calm their disposition in the current moment?
Why is that necessary?
Yeah.
No, I don't understand your question, because you're asking me this question as if that is necessary. I don't understand why that's necessary.
So what if someone's angry and their anger is causing no solutions to be brought to the table. And the problem just keeps reoccurring over and over and over. And you want to have them see a viewpoint that's hitting their blind spot. So for you, you said you call people out on their bullshit as like that's your main focus within consulting and your research.
It's not my main focus in the consulting and research. That's mostly my scientific advisory work is calling bullshit. In consulting, I'm actually helping people get where they want to go.
Exactly. So I appreciate that correction. And then for into that similar point, if you know someone really well, like if you're in someone's support network, challenge network, and you have a blind spot highlight, as my friend and I call it, in which we do, where you see like a weakness of theirs playing out, but they're super, super caught up in their own way in the current moment. How can you like open them up to see that they're doing something wrong? Because the same way within organizations, like you're one of your things that you have to really work through is helping people see that what they're doing is incorrect. But a lot of the time it hits just a complete brick wall and they won't hear you. So what have you found ways in which you can penetrate that impenetrable wall in a way?
It starts with not calling it wrong.
Mm.
Your entire question is premised on the fact that there's a right way and a wrong way, or that there's a better way and a worse way instead of a different way. And by the way, I can tell you that personally, that lesson took me a really long time to learn. And I would, you know, looking back on my life, I think one of my biggest failures in my life is that it took me way too long to learn that lesson in life.
So it's just like what you said with the point of flow before, not seeing it as like one thing or the other, just seeing it as what it is and what you experience.
Yeah. And so when you're talking about somebody who's got a blind spot, your first question should be, why do they have that blind spot? Not is that blind spot good, bad, right, wrong? Your first question is, why do they have it? They've got it for a reason, and it's obviously serving them in some way. So before you even touch that blind spot, you better find out why they have it and what benefit it does them. And incidentally, this approach is similarly how you approach consulting. It's how you approach a lot of conflict resolution. Many, many things go back to why are things this way? And the answer can't be an ism. So for instance, when I'm doing diversity consulting and I'm helping a company, and you look at why companies aren't diverse, if your answer is racism, you know what? Even if you're right, you have not stated the problem in an effective way. I think it was Bertrand Russell who said, the hardest thing about a problem is stating it in a way that allows for a solution, something to that effect. And similarly, it's like you're asking the wrong question, or you're providing, you know, a non-useful reason, even if correct.
Yeah, it has to lead to something else.
Right. And if you say, well, the company's not diverse because the company is racist, you know what? Even if you're right, you have just hit a dead end, because you can't knock out racism. When people talk about, like, how do you completely eliminate racism? You don't. Racism is a lot like energy. It's only going to transform from one thing to another. Human beings, in general, create groups and categories. And as long as human beings create we and they systems, perhaps that we they divide may not be race, in which case it won't be technically racism anymore. It'll be a different form of demographism. We will find ways to classify people by some kind of demographic, and certain people in that demographic will be we, certain people in that demographic will be they. And you know, people like to say there's an abundance mentality. We've got all sorts of abundant things in the world, but there is one thing that we don't have an abundance of, and that's time. So knowing that time for all of us is definitively finite, and that we can only spend so much of it, and nothing we do is gonna get us more, at least as far as we know right now, as long as that's true, there will always be, and as long as we need to classify people, which we do for, you know, our mental models of the world, because we don't have the time, effort, and energy to not classify people, there will always be we, they divisions. So now the question is that we, they division a useful one, right? It's a model, right? All models are wrong. This is an artificial we, they division. The question is, are you doing it in a useful way? So how do we get rid of racism? I wouldn't want to think about it that way, because what you're saying is, how do we get rid of we, they divisions? We don't.
Yeah.
We need them. But the question is, how do we make we they divisions that are useful? And most importantly, part of the definition of useful is that doesn't penalize people for things over which they have absolutely zero control. One of those things is what race you are. You have no control over that. That's just what you're born with.
Yeah.
So to make that we they division, that particular division isn't useful. And so when I'm going into companies and I'm doing diversity consulting, that's usually one of the things that gets discussed is, why do you have a low diversity? You've clearly found ways of delineating who is the we and who is the they. And in this case, the we is people belong in this company and people who should work in this company. And they is people who should not work in this company. Unfortunately, for a lot of companies, that we-they division also seems to have a bit of a correlation with the races and or ethnicities and or genders, certain other non-controllable demographics of, you know, the applicants, the people, and so on. And once you have that, that's not useful.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is useful? So what I go in there and I help them do is I help them create we-they divisions that are useful. And hopefully those divisions and the goal of those divisions is that they won't end up along the line of race. And one of the things I tell companies is that your diversity numbers are a lot like taking your temperature. If you've got what people would call quote unquote bad diversity numbers, that's like having a fever. You have no idea why. Like, you have no idea what's wrong with you. You only know that whatever you're doing, something's probably not going right. And that's where, you know, people like me come in. And, you know, we start actually investigating, diagnosing what's really going on. How is this happening? And that differential diagnosis is really how you get through that. But similarly, when people have got blind spots, you do the same thing. When you see a blind spot, something's wrong, but it may not be what you think it is. The blind spot is the symptom.
Yeah, yeah, it's that detachment of it too. Because then if you say this is wrong, you might be inserting your own way of looking at it, which could be ego-driven in some way that's not actually the best way to... So it's like, for what you're saying is just... And it answers a lot of the questions or meanings of the questions I was asking, which is like stepping outside oneself to just look at it in a better way and approach it in a different manner.
Yeah. And it's about, you know, being a bit more utilitarian, but also recognizing that people have reasons for what they do and respecting those reasons.
So there's going to be an innate empathy or compassion to...
No, respect.
Respect, okay.
I want to differentiate those because I may not empathize with you on this. I may not empathize with you and I may not have compassion for you on this, but I still respect that you, whoever it is, that person is who that person is. And even if I don't like what they're doing, if I don't feel that they deserve my compassion or my empathy, there's still this innate respect that is required.
Yeah, I mean, if you respect them, it shows you respect yourself in your own way too.
Yeah, it does. But most importantly, if people don't think you respect them, like, you don't necessarily have to empathize and you don't necessarily have to get where they're going. But part of that is, if you respect their individuality and you respect that they are who they are, that has to be the foundation of any conversation. And then, you know, they're in a position to hear what you have to say and weigh it according to whether you empathize or whether you have compassion. And you can even say something useful, very useful, that they can still remain useful even after they discount what you've said, because you don't have the empathy or compassion. Because, and they'll do that, analysis because there's respect.
They'll reverse engineer it into their own views. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. That's a great breakdown of it. And because this was, I absolutely love this entire topic we just went down. But to go into one avenue for a second, just being interested in the topic in general, I really want to learn more about it, heard about it. What is this hypnosis? And as you said, everything we're doing is, we don't know what we're doing. We're guessing, but what have you found with stuff you've done, and what have you done with trying to understand hypnosis?
So originally I thought of hypnosis, looking at trance as a way of maximizing our potential and capabilities. And I thought it was a very good vehicle for it. I still do, I should point out. I still think it's a great vehicle for that. But one of the funniest things about hypnosis is that, you know, over the years, Division 30 of the American Psychological Association has attempted to define hypnosis. Do you know that a bunch of leading scientists on hypnosis can't agree on what it is? And there's even this schism and this breakdown of two completely different camps. And what's even funnier is we don't know what hypnosis is. We don't know how hypnosis works. The joke I make about hypnosis is, you know, the experts on hypnosis, they're sort of like, you know, master manipulators of the microwave, right? Most people have no idea how a microwave works. They don't care how it works. They just put the food in, they hit a bunch of buttons, and out comes what they want. And hypnotists are really, really good at understanding which button combinations produce the right results. And that's what a lot of them study. And I don't want to knock that, I should point out, because hypnosis has so damn many buttons that it is an art, it is a science, but at the same time, we still have no idea what the hell is going on. I'll give you a simple example. Mm-hmm. All right, imagine I hypnotize you right now, and I tell you to raise your hand. Now, we have well documented the phenomenon that you're going to raise your hand. And then, you know, I tell you to put your hand down. I wake you up. I ask you, why did you raise your hand? And do you think it's because I made you? Now, this makes absolutely no sense. You and I aren't even sitting in the same room. How in hell could I be making you lift up your hand? I didn't touch your hand. And yet you don't think that you're the person who did it. And yet you have nothing else to attribute it to, so you attribute it to me. This is a well-documented phenomenon. Now, here's the question. What about hypnosis makes that happen? We haven't a clue. There are a couple different theories. One of them is that hypnosis changes your executive functioning. This leads to a lot of overdramatization in Hollywood and other assorted nonsense, but the way I would describe that change, if it's happening, is that it's sort of like anything you don't object to, you're much more likely to do. But that's part of the social contract that exists between the hypnotist and the participant. Although I'll get back to that discrepancy in a minute. Hold that thought. The other theory says that hypnosis changes your perception over your executive functioning. So what hypnosis does is it helps you dissociate from perceiving yourself as the person who engages in action. You step back from that, and you're able to experience things more automatically. But what's really funny is a little bit of a misnomer of that people don't understand about hypnosis, and this is probably the most important thing that people don't understand. And when I teach it, I always start with this because it is rule number one, and I tell everybody, rule number one, all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. When we think of hypnosis, to hypnotize, which is a transitive verb, right? The idea that I hypnotize you, right? That actually makes zero sense. I don't do anything to you, right? You do this all yourself. The hypnotist is the guide. Now, I'm a very experienced guide. I've been doing this for a long time. I'm a very experienced guide. I've been doing, you know, a lot of guiding of people. But you're the one who engages calling all the shots. And thinking of a hypnotist more as an advisor, somebody who may know the terrain better than you, but you're the one walking the terrain. So I'm the one who can tell you how to draw the map, how to navigate, where you probably need to be going, and common places that people go to, but you're doing it.
Yeah, it's like a Sherpa of someone climbing a mountain.
More than that, I think, because you're carrying your own gear. I'm not carrying your gear, and I'm doing a lot more guiding, and I'm getting a lot more feedback from you. There's definitely always when somebody's working with somebody else doing hypnosis, what we might call heterohypnosis, as opposed to auto hypnosis. So auto, you're doing it just to yourself and only by yourself. Heterohypnosis, where there's somebody else guiding you through the process. There is a very, very deep partnership that happens in that. So you and I, we work together on that. And you know, I get feedback from you. Milton Erickson, who is considered the grandfather of modern hypnosis, probably considered one of the greatest hypnotists of all time, at one point said something to the effect of, my clients tell me what I'm supposed to do. It's funny because everybody sees themselves as going to him, and he's like, they tell me what they need. I just listen to them, and they tell me what they need, and then I do it.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciate that entire explanation, as I'm sure there's so much to uncover, but the depth with that was really great. And to that one point of it too, I find it's such a good principle to abide by with, especially for you as a consultant too, as one of your roles in life, and even like a life coach, if someone were to be that, or a life partner with someone, you don't help someone, like someone, you don't cure someone's problems. You're just like a way in which they can help themselves do it. I think there's a great quote. I can't even recall it because it's not top of mind, but someone said to this author once, like, I loved your book. You helped me cure this thing. And he was like, oh, I didn't help you do anything. You helped yourself. Like, I was just a toolkit. So it's that I like the one thing I would extract from what you said towards the end of that too is not detaching oneself to their craft too much, or like thinking they cured someone of something where it's just they're the helper. They're the agent. Catalyst. Yeah. Richard Keller. I know you know of him from Next Gen. He the catalyst effect. Use that word. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of practitioners do, is we're helping to catalyze the change. And the thing about a lot of catalysts, and something that people miss, is that sometimes with the right context, you can do things without a catalyst. A catalyst makes it easier. And you know, something I also mentioned in the TED Talks, that the catalyst reduces the activation energy, and that, you know, was I found a lot of analogies from chemistry in life, and I use them a lot.
Yeah, that's probably so true. You find even more themes than I can even imagine, because you were studying the things that make the material all around us. So there has to be some like patterns as to how that system operates itself and to how we function, because you know we are atoms, we are energy, we are chemistry.
You had to see the look on my professor's face when I was a doctoral student taking organizational behavior, as I started making comparisons to the Boltzmann distribution, and my professor's just looking at me like, okay.
Yeah, whatever you say, Oren.
Pretty much.
And so the one thing of what you said with hypnosis that also connects with flow in your step-by-step process of, and also habits, is the automatic aspect of it. It get to a point where something becomes so second nature. And I'm finding through my living that repetition is just the really end all be all of many things. Cause it causes that automatic process to take place where we're getting outside of ourselves, and obviously doing repetition in the aspect of making something good, like morally good, ethically good, mentally, physically, spiritually sound. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, we recognize that on those things, there's no ceiling, but also with flow, it's not about repetition and it's not about automaticity.
Yeah, more,
either. Autotoolicity, yes, but automaticity.
Oh, no. So that was the characteristics of flow, was the automaticity of it. Yeah.
But it's not, it's autotelicity. So auto itself, and telos is from the Greek for goal, I think, something along those lines. But the idea is that it's the intrinsic motivation, doing the activity for the sake of doing it. So, for example, I play bridge because I like playing bridge. I mean, you know, obviously I'm playing to win. And, you know, bridge is one of those things where I find I'm not nearly as good as I want to be. And I'm, you know, I'm developing, but I like to play. I like the game. I like the process of the game. I like, you know, thinking about the game, learning about the game when I can find a minute to do it. But I play bridge to play bridge. And, you know, if I play a good game and I've played well, I'm satisfied regardless of the outcome. And if I played a lousy game and, like, you know, I realized that I totally screwed this hand up, but I got lucky because, you know, the break went my way. Like, okay, well, I got lucky, but I'm not feeling satisfied.
Yeah, and that was, I think there was another, correct me if I'm wrong, another part of the process of the characteristics of flow is was basically not like doing something you enjoy, or not like, like basically the example of you end up getting a like when you're a teenager, you end up getting a relationship or this romantic girl as a part of your life and as your girlfriend because you don't try as hard. So it's like that one aspect or like pillar for characteristics of flow, as you said, is not trying like too hard. But I would love for you to expand on that more, because I'm not like hitting it correctly, nail on the head.
So a lot of this, actually, I would argue that flow is about trying. But so many things, like getting a romantic partner, you know, whatever gender you find attractive, is, you know, like when you try too hard, you're not really putting forth a genuine effort.
Exactly, the genuinity. Yeah, that's
the genuineness of the effort. And when people are trying too hard, most of the time, when you're trying too hard, it means that you've invested too much in the outcome and not enough in the process. Whereas, you know, but that does not at all mean that you should not be deliberate. Like if you are trying to find a romantic partner, then, you know, whichever gender you find attractive, like you should be pursuing, you know, people of those gender or genders in a deliberate way, and not in a calculated way in that you're so bent on the outcome, but that in a way that allows you to create meaningful relationships that may also develop into romantic ones.
Yeah.
Go for genuine results. And it's the same thing when you want to experience flow, go for things that lead to genuine enjoyment of the activity, whether you experience flow or not. I actually don't get that much flow playing bridge. It just happens not to be a flow activity for me so much yet. Maybe in part because I find that I'm not yet good enough at bridge, and I'm not very good at picking challenges that fit my skill level. Whenever I'm playing in groups, I'm finding I'm either in a group where everybody's much better than I am, or I'm finding groups where everybody is nowhere near as good as I am, and I'm not actually that good. But I'm in that zone of like, you know, beginner intermediate, where I just find my I don't know how to assess my level, and so I can't pick appropriate challenges. Whereas other things, I know how to pick the right challenges. I've got a good sense of my skill level, but my only knowledge of my skill level in bridge is not that good. That's not very meaningful. I enjoy it, but I'm still not that good at it. Whereas other things, I've been doing it for a long time. I've been a ballroom dancer for a long time. And so I've got a pretty good idea of my skill level, so I can find the right challenges for that skill level. And I'm going, and I have very specific goals, which, remember, in flow, you need goals, clear goals, and a knowledge and some way to know whether you're achieving those goals. So when I dance, I know how to pick a challenge, a goal that will be challenging for me to reach relative to my skill level. And I choose the goal, and it's not always the goal that every dancer has. They're my goals.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because it might have been one of the things I was trying to grab on before when trying to ask the question. I've been loving, absolutely loving golf, because the feedback's instant. And you have a goal of where you want to hit it, especially if you're on a range. You have a measurability. It shows you how far it goes. And it's instant feedback. Like especially if you record yourself, you know how your form's incorrect. And it's just that constant repetition. And I've been finding maybe my flow activity is, this is a breakthrough if it is, just going to that golfing range, and just even playing golf too, but especially a golfing range, because it's not as live in action. So there's not as much judgment, but I get more reps if I'm on a range. So I find that correlation interesting, because, and also that process of how you explained it, it's fascinating. I really hope someone uses that listens to this episode.
I think that any activity can be a flow activity. So the fact that you have not found flow going to the range means that the goal you chose is not necessarily the sort of goal that's more conducive to flow, but you could find that. So for example, if you're going to the range, you know, some of that could be, where is the challenge for you? See, when you go to the range, your goal is not challenge. But if you were to bring challenge to that, instead, you're going to the range for practice, and that brings up the issue of deliberate practice and trying to make sure that you're doing deliberate practice, and that is a good thing. And sometimes deliberate practice can be flow, sometimes not. But a lot of that is going to depend upon whether you choose the right challenges that you're intrinsically motivated, that challenges that include goals that you're intrinsically motivated to go after. In other cases, you just need to drill and do it. And that will lead to your finding greater skills and also, you know, more opportunities for flow when you play golf.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There, it's like that initial fascination that leads you there, and then the practice over time that'll help you get to this better level. And then the one question I was going to ask is it then not possible to find flow in something you're just like very inadequate at? Because they say accept your inadequacy in order to like move forward, especially into happiness. But in context to like skill and flow, and you talked about like with bridge, you're not as good, so it might not be a flow activity of like the highest of sorts for you. So is it like if you really want to do something but you're not as good, is it harder to get into that flow state? Or I don't want to say state, but
flow experience.
Flow experience. I'm changing my diction with everything now, thanks to you.
So a lot of this is, it's not about what level you're at. Remember what I said, my problem with bridge is that I don't have a good way of knowing how good I am. Or maybe a better way to put that is how bad I am.
So it starts with the awareness, like measurability to it. Exactly. So it's like, sorry to cut you off for a sec. It's like, if you were to start a new nutritional diet, it's like you have to track everything to then use it as your baseline and metric to move forward.
And I don't know how to do that. And I should point out that I could find myself a bridge teacher. And if I had the time and the resources to do this, and I really had the time, the ability, the wherewithal to do all this, what I would do is I'd find a bridge teacher, somebody who really understands the game. And that person could help me understand what level I'm at and where the challenge zone is for me. Where's the sweet spot where it's challenging, but not too challenging. It's not too easy. It's not too hard. And moreover, what drills I need to do to advance. I mean, one of the things I know, for example, those who play bridge will know this, you know, when to finesse, when not to finesse. Haven't gotten that down yet. And it's an important bit of knowledge in a game of bridge. You know, when you're the caller and you got to know, when do you need to finesse something and when you don't. And I'm still learning that. And that's, you know, one of the lessons, how to preserve entries. Again, something else bridge people know. Still getting the hang of knowing exactly when and how to do that based on how the defenders are playing.
Yeah. Yeah. And two more things I was going to bring up is, one, people I'm finding with all of this deep discussion today, they beat themselves up without even knowing where they're at, which is very counterproductive. And then a lot of what you do, and I'm sure you like him a lot, is what Josh Waitzkin really focuses on with the aspect of learning. But I'm finding him interesting because he has a cool approach to trying to master things, even though mastery, it'll never occur because there's constantly improvement going on, but like a high level of skill with something.
So I admit that I am not, I know who Josh Waitzkin is. His work is also on my list of things I want to check out.
Yeah.
It looks interesting, but one of the things that I push back on, not necessarily against Waitzkin, because I don't know how he operationalizes this at all, but some people, when they talk about mastery, is what is the definition of mastery?
Yeah, exactly.
And I find that some people that talk about like, well, master this quickly, I don't, you know, I would look at that and I would say that's not mastery. Whereas other people might say that that's mastery. So part of what you need to do, so to speak, if you're going to buy into that, is you need to buy into the fact that their definition of mastery is accurate.
Yeah, and it's what you said.
I'm not sure it is.
Yeah, it's what you said to your constant point, and also your TEDx talk, is find out how people do things, find out like their background and which the way they perceive, and then you can backtrack to, mm-hmm. How does this work for me? I think people, I mean, to your emphasis, they might attach too much to something and not view it in the way they should. In a way, in short, like change their perspective on the process. Like, how do I do what I do?
Yeah. And it raises a lot of questions about, you know, what constitutes mastery. So for instance, people say, like, you know, is a world champion of something a master? Now, here's the thing. It's hard to say no to that. But the other question is, do you agree that the criteria that were used to establish the world champion are in fact criteria that reflect mastery? Now, if you're not an expert in that field, you don't know. At the same time, whether you want to achieve mastery or like what your definition of mastery will be, do you agree with the experts? Don't you agree with the experts? In a certain sense, that doesn't matter because it's what's meaningful to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And so, like, is that kind of mastery the kind that you want? So people ask me, why was I never a competitive ballroom dancer? And part of that was, I understand what they're talking about as mastery in ballroom dance. I respect that, but that's not meaningful to me, which is why I don't do competitive ballroom. And I find that those goals... And I have friends that are excellent at that and are extremely high-level ballroom dancers, but I find that I don't want that kind of mastery. You know, they may have it and I don't, but I don't like the process. To me, not to them, but to me, it ruins the art. To them, it does not. But yeah. Part of it is I find in my discussions with them, we disagree about what the art of ballroom dance is.
Yeah, it has to be that way in a way. Yeah.
But the thing is, like, so let us suppose that the forms that I consider to be part of the art that I would consider the mastery are not judged by some international board, then what is mastery there? And part of that is, you know, my answer to that question is, am I satisfied with it? Am I at the level that I want to be, knowing fully that, you know, there's always more to learn and there are always better people, but am I hitting levels that I want to hit?
Mm.
And am I getting to levels? Am I still a good student? Similarly, I knew a martial arts master, and I remember hearing him say once that he said that in his dojo, the day somebody gets a black belt is the day that they stop being a client and start being a student. That was impactful for me, and that left me thinking a lot about mastery and master experiences, because we usually think of black belts as like somebody getting their black belt as like the lowest level master, and here this master who's like extremely high level, like world class, and he's saying like, yeah, black belt's the day you become a student. Till then you're still a client or customer. And it's like, wow, that, like, okay, so getting your black belt is like day one in martial arts. And I know that a lot of dojos don't think that way.
I like that a lot. That's good. I'm definitely going to mark that down. I will be going through this episode plenty, as I know many others will. But before we end, I always like to leave a space for you to explain, like, any bigger aspirations you have or anything top of mind, especially within this year. But I'll just leave that space to you if there is some.
So one of the things that I really like to encourage people to do, as hard as it is to pursue self-knowledge. Because I found the more that I look at self-actualization, the more I find that the people that don't get it and that have trouble hitting that upward spiral are people who don't know themselves very well. They don't necessarily want to, or they're scared to, or, and by the way, knowing ourselves, knowing those deep, dark places that we don't want to admit are there and that we don't want to believe are there, you know, it's seeing, you know, the light side of ourselves and the dark side of ourselves, and knowing our strengths, knowing our insecurities, those things are really, really tough to do, but they're required. If we want to actually make the most of the uniqueness that we have, and those insecurities, those weaknesses, they often, if we can look them in the face, and not all of us can, it's hard, it's painful, it's scary, we need help with that, and like, you know, and admitting that we need help with that, but those things can become wellsprings of energy, of motivation, and also I should point out, wellsprings of the uniqueness that we have, those experiences that have shaped us and that we use to further shape ourselves, they come from, you know, that self-knowledge, it's hard to get, but it's something that I think is one of the most valuable things on Earth, in part because that's what gives us paths to meaning.
Mm.
So I always encourage people, do that as much as you can. Get help if you have to. And you're going to need a lot of help. Like, that's not help from one person. That's not just a therapist. You're going to need people who know you well, whether that is friends, family, intimate partners. And I use intimate writ large, not necessarily just romantic intimate partners, but also people that know you intimately and people that with whom you have partnered in the development of intimate knowledge.
Mm.
All those people can be helpful with that. And along those lines, I found, you know, in studying the research and through my own experiences and talking to a hell of a lot of other people, that it's amazing how much you accomplish when you're doing for other people.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So those two things I think are important. And as much as possible, be honest with yourself. And along those lines, you know, we were talking about compassion, self-compassion, something Kristen Neff talks about. And Kristen Neff has an amazing TED Talk on this. If you have not seen Kristen Neff's TED Talk, that should be on your to-do list for today. it is Kristen Neff's TED Talk is one of the top 10. I've watched a lot. I've seen a lot. Kristen Neff's TED Talk is one of the top 10 that I have ever encountered, along with Brené Brown's. Also top 10.
You're great.
There are a couple others that are incredible, but those two, if you haven't seen Kristen Neff's TED Talk today.
Yeah, I'll put it in the description. There's a ton of links I'll be able to put in there, but I'm so happy you brought up the things to focus on, because I was going to ask, but I'm glad I didn't before we got to this. Mm-hmm. What, like, things to focus on and characteristics to really just hone in on. So I'm so happy it focuses on self. It's like this internal to then external self-actualization, manifestation, identity. So,
but then self-transcendence.
And then self, the most.
But to understand that self-actualization is a means to self-transcendence.
Which is, in a way, which is amazing that we got to this at the end. It's like the death of, I don't know, like ego death. I don't know, like going outside of self and like seeing your like goneness in a way. I can't really phrase it, but like basically accepting death.
Well, I don't know about accepting death, but accepting your own uniqueness and your wherewithal to contribute to the world. And that doesn't necessarily have to be at a big, famous, you know, what we call big C creative level.
Okay.
It's about making a difference that only you can make.
I see. Okay. Got it.
And, you know, in that sense, you know, for those who are religious, what I would point out is those who are religious see life as sacred and that life contains a spark of godliness in it. And, you know, in that sense, through self-actualization, we actualize the godliness within and we partner with God. Almost all those religions see God as the creator of the universe. And so we partner, you know, in that sense, we develop a certain human deity partnership in fulfilling the uniqueness that the deity put in us.
Yeah, being the co-creator of your destiny.
Well, being the co-creator in the universe, not just your destiny, but, you know, for religious folks, most religions, you know, see humankind as joining with the deity in co-creating the universe in their own way and through the use, or I should say actualization, of the divine spark that is within them through their creation. Now, I freely admit I don't know how atheists frame this. But what I would say is probably, you know, atheists would sort of look at this as, you know, just fulfilling the promise of your own uniqueness anyway. They probably just wouldn't ascribe that uniqueness to any deity. It's just, you know, you have this uniqueness and that's something to be fulfilled because that's who you are, however you became who you are. It's a guess. I'm not an atheist, so
yeah.
Couldn't quite tell you. You know, I admit to my lack of knowledge here. I am very much religious.
Yeah, no, likewise. I'm glad you clarified the point of self-transcendence. I'm just super happy we ended on this note, and I really could not express into words or measure like gratitude right now. So I really appreciate you coming on, and it's gonna be valuable for all. If you're listening now, thank you for listening.
I hope so, and thank you all for listening as well. And I hope that this is very helpful to everyone.
I'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Anthony.